You already know the power of technology, but we also know that technology can make a difference for good. Well, here's a story that will inspire you on just how productive you can be with awesome tools and the difference you can make in the world. That's this episode of Dev Radio. Hi, and welcome to the next episode of Microsoft Dev Radio. I'm Jerry Nixon, and I'm here with Kate, Vicky, and Nora, all from Urban Refuge, and they're about to talk us through some of the work that our evangelists are doing in the field to help solve problems that are real-world problems that can help guide developers as they're trying to solve their own and inspire them to be able to accomplish it with the tooling that's really at their fingers. Often these are tools that are very forward-looking, very cutting-edge, and it's an exciting conversation. Kate, Vicky, Nora, thanks for being on the show today.
Thank you for having us.
Now, I want to talk to you guys specifically, but I don't want to miss out on James. James is here. He's our evangelist who is the technical resource for this project. James, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you.
Yeah. James, where are you located, James?
I'm in New York City right now, but I'm from Boston, so.
Yes, you are. Yeah. And you and I are colleagues. That's exactly right. All right. Nora, let's start with you. Tell me who you are first, and then let's talk about Urban Refuge.
Yes. Okay. So, Nora Loria, I'm an assistant professor of international relations at the Pardee School of Global Studies, which is a new school, the newest school at Boston University. And it's a policy school that has both professors of practice who've been in the real world and then professors like me who have PhDs. And we're trying to really think about how to impact policy in new ways. And so I taught this class. I have a strong interest in forced migration and human trafficking, and I started an initiative at BU when I first joined a couple of years ago. And I just ended up having all these students that were superstars. And I wanted to get some of the energy that they bring to things like MUN and student government, but bring it to real government and real UN problems. And so that was kind of the basis for the class, was to teach a policy class where the output was not going to be a written policy recommendation like these classes usually produce, for two simple reasons. One, we know that policymakers generally don't read these recommendations. We have quantitative proof that shows that. And two, and I mean, I think that especially we're filming right after election, I didn't vote in this election. I've never voted in any election. I've never actually been politically enfranchised anywhere. I was born and raised in Bahrain, and our constitution and elections were suspended in 77. They were brought back in 2001. I missed that election by 3 weeks because of my 18th birthday. And then by the following fall, I was here. So I think also just on a much larger scale, what does it mean to be a political scientist and have to really think about impact beyond just talking to policymakers and telling them to do things that are good for their constituency. So I gave them a challenge that was very broad, and the outcome was focus on a specific urban problem that has to do with forced migrants. And at the end of the class, instead of a written policy recommendation, what would you build as a blueprint for either like a local municipality or NGOs or refugees on the ground? What kind of digital infrastructure could you build? And I did this, by the way, having zero background in tech, not even knowing what a back end was. So, I mean, James really kind of stepped up and built something for us. And I never, ever expected this to actually work. It was just an experiment. And I just wanted to engage them in a different way and engage myself in a different way and not feel hopeless because I can't vote or feel like the rest of us have to sit back and just watch the people who are running for office and think of impact only on that way.
All right. Well, this is going to be an interesting conversation, I can tell already. Kate, welcome to the show. Tell us who you are.
My name is Kate. Kate Scow. I'm in Portland right now. I went to Boston University. I took Professor Laurie's. I'm supposed to call her Nora now that I'm no longer a graduate student. I took Nora's class on forced migration and human trafficking, and I am now the director of technology of Urban Refuge. Wow. The class was amazing. She is right. It is full of superstars. It was undergraduates and graduates alike coming together to
all
focus
women.
On this problem. All women. And I just knew this was something special and that I had to be a part of it. And I was part of a team that was working on the design of the app. And I don't know that much about technology other than I use it a lot. And I know that it's a core part of basically everyone's life and it has the potential to be very impactful and make the world a better place. So I'm so excited to be part of a group that's doing that.
Beautiful. Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. There's so much opportunity to make the world better through technology. I think all of science fiction movies, except for a handful, have it all wrong. They always show technology making it worse. You know what I mean? That's not the real world, you know? Parents don't love their children. Now, Vicky, tell us who you are.
So I'm Vicky Kelber. I am now the Chief Empowerment Officer of Urban Refuge. So my job is really to empower the group to keep doing this incredibly important work because they're all volunteers. So every single student at the end of the semester was given a host of options for future involvement, and every single person of the 25-person class, more or less, signed up to be a fully participatory member of the group. So, you know, I kind of corral everybody and have an eye in the sky of what's going on, and it's really only served to reinforce my impression that all of these students are incredibly capable, intelligent, and powerful people that are powerful beyond, I think, even their own estimations at the beginning of the class. And my other life, I'm a master's student studying international affairs here at the Party School of Global Studies.
Very cool. All right, so we've used the term urban refuge quite a bit here. I assume that a lot of people listening won't know what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. Maybe, Vicky, you can help me out. What's urban refuge?
So Urban Refuge is an app for refugees, and as you can tell from the prior conversation, it was actually born in a classroom. And so the idea behind Urban Refuge is that right now we obviously are in the midst of a global historical migration crisis. And much of this crisis comes from the fact that the infrastructure to support refugees and migrants simply doesn't exist in a lot of the countries where they're primarily based in the developing world. And so the class itself was focused on Jordan, and specifically the Syrian refugee crisis in Jordan. And through doing research, students realized that one of the central problems for refugees in Jordan is that, unlike the stereotype of refugees, most of them don't live in refugee camps. Most of them live in cities. And so, you know, normally when you think of a refugee, you think of, you know, tents in the desert behind a barbed wire fence, and that's just not the case for 80% of Syrians that live in Jordan. And so accessing aid becomes so much more difficult because you're just in a city. And just like any city, there's dispersed organizations all around. Some of them have zero web presence. Some of them are so small that literally they only operate through word of mouth. And so Urban Refuge was born from this idea that a very simple but powerful intervention is to put aid on the map. And what the app actually does is take each aid location, you know, the big international organizations, which are fairly mappable already, but also small local organizations that are doing a lot of the groundwork and a lot of the frontline implementers, and coding them by latitude and longitude. And so refugees and other members of the community can very easily search for healthcare services, education, shelter assistance, cash for work, anything that really is in this host of aid and assistance that exists, and are much better able to connect with those services. And the services, on the flip side, are much better able to connect with their beneficiaries.
And so, Kate, I guess if I'm in a refugee camp, I just stand up and yell and I can find other refugees. And if I'm in a city, I'm isolated. Is that what you're trying to solve?
Yeah, I think we thought about it that way, that the access to aid dramatically decreases because, yeah, you're living with so many people and there are regular citizens, there are travelers, there are refugees, there are migrant workers. And there's a whole host of different kinds of people in a city population. So it's not as easy to find the answers and find the resources that you need because not everyone is looking for what you need, like in the way that the camps are, where everyone is sort of in the same situation. We also thought about this app as how could it also help the local population, because there are resources there like education and health that any citizen in a new city would be really appreciative of sort of having a database like this. So we didn't just develop this for refugees, even if it came out of developing a policy solution for refugees.
Yeah.
And we also really found it important to put agency back in the hands of refugees. So often they're sort of told what to do and what aid they can have, and they don't get a lot of choice in the matter. And that can be really dehumanizing. So we felt giving, all of them have smartphones, almost all of them have smartphones. They can all make choices. We want to empower them to make their own choices about their own lives.
Now, Nora, is that one of the, is that one of the assumptions that we make, is that these are refugees, they're not going to have technology?
Actually, so this crisis, unlike most other refugee crises, has really changed because of smartphone penetration. So we've seen that really smartphones are overtaking any other form of even laptops or TVs or any other form of communication. And even on the route, people are setting up charging stations. So the certain NGOs, I remember when I'm in the field, who, you know, have a mission, for example, of reconnecting families in other refugee crises, like in East Africa, when they've come into Jordan, have realized that not only is there the smartphone penetration, but there's the tech infrastructure. Amman is like the Silicon Valley. They call it the Silicon Valley of the Middle East, right? So there's a huge tech community there, which means that it's also about building on what already exists. And two other things about Jordan. First of all, it's the highest refugee host in the world. And it's the fourth most water-starved country in the world. And it gets way less attention than a country like Turkey, because Turkey had an impact on Europe. But I think that this was really also an effort to think about how can you help host societies that are actually taking on huge numbers of refugees. And I think that the question you asked, Kate, about the camp versus the urban, it's such a puzzle, right? Because actually, in camp settings, you have fewer number of service providers, but people know where they are. Whereas in the urban setting, you actually have a greater infrastructure, but the lack of information shrouds it. So it's not that people don't find them. They find them through Facebook groups and through other things, but that's not a really systematic, clear way of just putting aid on a map.
Right. Okay, so James, you still with us?
Yeah, I'm here.
Lights are still on. James, tell me a little bit about, somebody comes to you and says, I need an application that needs to be run on basically any device. What sort of thing do you start to think about?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing they came to me is they said they wanted an Android application, and that's because that's one of the number one use cases, the phones over there. But then when we started talking, they had much broader vision of being able to have this on an iOS device, even in a Windows device in some settings, and reach a much broader population than just the Android. And, you know, the first thing they said was the Android device, and they weren't sure how they were going to get that to go to other phones. They were going to develop the Android device and then maybe tackle the iOS device later on. And so when they came to me that, and I said, hey, well, if we use this particular technology called Xamarin, we're going to be able to actually develop not only for Android, but iOS at the same time. And they just lit up.
Totally.
Yeah.
There's going to be a cost in time. There's going to be a cost in time and labor and money all to build this. And every platform multiplies that. And Xamarin saves a lot of that cost.
Yeah. And so, because we're talking about Amman, Jordan here, we're also talking about having this be a localization issue. We have to be able to have all the languages, all the resources translated from not only in English, but also in Arabic. And so when you start to look at having to do all that translation and serve up all of those translations in the app, you're going to have to do it for Android, you're going to have to do it for iOS, you're going to have to do it for Windows. And so now with Xamarin, we're actually doing it once, and we're serving it up through the app once. So we're really cutting back on that time.
Can I add one thing about Xamarin?
Yeah.
This was another email I sent James that was totally incomprehensible, but for me, that was one of the coolest things that they integrated because of its pedagogical value. And I think that what this class did was it really like created, there's a niche of people who are interested in humanitarian work, and it's primarily women, actually. And it's not necessarily the same kind of people who go into tech. And so this class really pulled new people, including new faculty, into the tech world. And what didn't happen is that actually by incorporating Xamarin, we didn't end up with something that is a complete completely finished product. So my students can still learn how to adapt it. We can think about how do we make this scalable to other cities. We're bringing it to Boston in the fall in a class that I'm teaching. And for me, that was really key because my favorite moment in the class was going from them being like, well, how are we supposed to do this, Professor Lurie? We don't have any tech skills and we don't know anything about this, to having just one meeting.
That's what they actually sounded like.
Right, yes. Guys? That's what you sound
yes.
like, right?
That was me. That was saying, I don't know how to build anything.
That was actually Kate. And
then 3 weeks later, I was going to coding classes because I thought I was going to build this app myself somehow. So we've all been really empowered to learn sort of what goes on behind all of our favorite tech.
Yeah, and they came back and they're like, oh, it's so easy. You just Google code. And it's true. You can't, I mean, you can't just Google code and build an app, but it totally demystified it for them to just talk to people. And in that case, it was other computer science undergrads. And so I think that they're excited to work with James and Gavin, and Xamarin actually keeps that process going, and it allows for our professional development and to kind of think about these questions of scalability.
James, is this a straightforward app?
You know, and on first look, it almost sounds pretty straightforward, but there's actually quite a bit going on with the way that we have to serve up the information across the wire and display on the map, and then making sure that, you know, the refugees can actually access this when they lose internet connection. So, I mean, they're going to be walking around using this thing on a map. How do you actually make sure that they can access the resources when they're not connected, and how do they actually get that updated into the app? So that was one of the challenges.
One of your approaches there to give them offline access?
Yeah, so essentially being able to cache some of that data locally. So when they first connect to the app, I'll load up all the resources that they're looking at, and then I cache that locally. And as the as they use it, they can interact with it as if they're offline. And then when there's an update, I periodically check for updates, and the update will then sync, and I'll just kind of sync the two bits together. And to them, it seems pretty seamless. They get a little notification that, you know, they got an update and they're ready to go.
Nice. And now tell me, this is the type of app that's going to be all over the world. This is going to be the type of app that's going to be in places where you didn't expect it. Mm-hmm. You want to be able to kind of track, follow, be able to service it in the proper way. What kind of stuff did you introduce that helped with that?
Yeah, so I think one of the key things is they wanted to figure out which actual resources were being used by categories. And so we... and then not only that, but they're also going to be testing this thing out in Amman, Jordan, where I already mentioned where the connection issues can be pretty prevalent. So if there's any crashing of the application, we want to be able to collect all of that. You also want to be able to collect the information that they're of the user and what they're actually doing. And so we introduced Hockey App to actually solve that problem.
Yeah. And you're using Hockey App for logging and telemetry and delivery, or what do you use Hockey App for?
So part of that, we have a Visual Studio Team Services account set up, and I've put in a continuous build pipeline. And so I can press a button, and that app gets actually deployed out. And I think Vicky got to experience this, where it actually she gets a notification and says, hey, there's a new version of this app.
Yep,
and
I have.
She can download it. And then you can actually press it, and if the app crashes, we get that notification back. And that was actually super helpful for me, because Vicky, the first time I rolled it out to you, I think it didn't work.
It didn't.
But I was able to dive in, and I got a stack trace and actually find out exactly where it was going wrong. I had put the wrong connection string into to connect back to the database.
You're the first developer to have ever done that, James.
Yes, exactly. So I was able to, without her even saying, you know, the app crashed and didn't work, and I was able to just fix that and roll it out the next time, and it was working from there on out. So, you know, Hockey App was super important there. And then also being able to see all the different data points. And then I think they're going to be using this in January. They're going to be rolling this out as a beta, and they're going to be out in the field actually walking around, working with the application. And they're going to be able to roll this app out as there's new updates and as there's new information coming available, they can actually then just push it out to their beta testers.
Yep. How many platforms do we have in line here that in January we'll see?
Yeah, so we're going to see Android and iOS.
Cool.
Windows actually works also, but we're not going to be rolling that out right away. So.
Yep. Okay. Okay, great.
I'd like to say something about Hockey App because it's life-changing for me from a research perspective.
Sure.
Because, I mean, the way that I think of social science research, especially, I mean, I'm much more of an ethnographer and archival, and I do archival work because a lot of the quantitative work uses these pre-existing indices, and if you don't like the data, then it doesn't really make sense to input it into a model. And so, you know, as we were rolling this out, my own research agenda was to spend the rest of this year on leave, writing NSF grants, going in to do a survey treatment the following year. I would have data 6 months after that, and then I would be trying to publish very quickly. And Hockey App just allows me to gather the analytics through the back end of the app, which is incredible. And it also doesn't then require the less reliable results of self-reporting. So it's this passive data collection that, if we have the right number of users, could be a really, really powerful variable that tells us about the demand side of aid by space, which is incredible because I know what kind of data streams go into the existing evidence-based models for how we allocate aid. And I mean, that's why I sort of went into a rabbit hole the minute I got the write-up from James and realized what we had on our hands. And I sent him like a million emails. They were like, oh my God, do you understand? Do you understand what this could do? Do you understand, like, actually having the demand side and actually having the space, it's so much more powerful. You can build models that are much more powerful than a basic econometric model that only looks at one variable like expenditures and then determines whether a family is going to get aid or not. So the research possibilities, especially in the long term, as we develop larger sample sizes and more users, are really, really incredible.
Yeah, isn't it funny how these tools that have such a specific value also have these side effect values that sometimes can be the serendipitous find and
the gem that you find. Oh my God, it was the biggest gift. It's like my students gave me this really amazing research gift.
We gave you tenure.
Inshallah, we hope. We hope. Still need to publish.
Vicky, what part of this app do you think will make the biggest difference?
I mean, I think there's really three main things that we're hoping to see, and obviously we'll be testing throughout the user experience to make sure that our assumptions are true. And I think first and foremost is what Kate mentioned earlier about putting the choice back in the hands of people who are using the app. You know, not only refugees, other migrant communities, members of the host communities, these are generally populations that are all vulnerable, all living in poorer areas. And so empowering people to just make that choice and say, I don't want to go to this clinic, I want to go to this clinic. It's closer, it's more convenient to me. It's a really powerful thing for people who are used to, again, their treatment is generally top-down, passive receipt of aid, and no one wants to be dependent on aid.
Yeah.
I think the second, as Nora mentioned, really powerful thing is the implications that this has for the way that humanitarian responses are carried out in urban areas. Because again, it's really difficult to reach refugees, to have refugees be in contact with organizations trying to provide them with services or information or legal advice or whatever it is. And so these types of digital solutions are really, I mean, the way of the future in humanitarianism in urban spaces, because it enables you to connect people in a way that doesn't require that you geographically isolate them in a camp. Mm-hmm. That's, again, very important for a variety of reasons. I think that it is the global impact that is really exciting, because urban refuge isn't just something for places in the developing world, although that's where we designed it. Like Nora mentioned, we want to bring it to Boston, where there's a huge amount of resettled refugees. There's a huge demand for this in places like Berlin or Beirut or Turkey. So there's a lot. It's a really nice kind of common tool that it doesn't depend on what your income level is. It doesn't even depend on how many refugees you have. Regardless of where you are, mapping technology is a really powerful thing, And so it can improve lives across a host of populations, not just refugees.
Yeah, including host populations. Exactly. I mean, like, you know, where are the hospitals? Where are the schools in your neighborhood? Just basic infrastructure in cities, having that mapped, I think, could make a big difference. And I think we don't even know, because we're just thinking about our own sort of silo and our own research questions. But that's what's exciting about making the data available to others. Yeah. And sort of, I mean, James not only translated for us and the student, for the students, he translated for me, because after this, I am now working a lot more closely with people in the computer, the Hariri Center for Computing and Computer Engineering, and I don't think I would have known how to discuss some of these larger sort of modeling questions or research questions if I hadn't been thinking in this way after sort of looking at what Hockey App could do, for example.
Yeah. Is this a Xamarin app with native heads or native UI, or are you using Xamarin Forms?
Yeah, we're actually using Xamarin Forms. So it's a nice, easy way to actually develop the UI once. And for this, in particular, this one, there's a mapping tool that we could plug into Xamarin Forms that works cross-platform. It uses Google Maps when you're on Android. It uses iOS Maps when you're on iOS and Bing when you're on Windows. So it was just, you know, you plug in this map, and then I was able to find a couple different solutions where I could actually data bind that data using the XAML. And it makes the map just kind of flow as the data gets updated and as the user kind of works around it.
Very nice. Did you feel productive while you were doing it?
That was awesome. So I come from a background of doing WPF development, so I kind of already knew about XAML. And for me, mobile development is actually fairly new. And I was able to actually have a prototype and show something to Kate. I think it was like a week and a half in. I had something, you know, end-to-end, including a database and a API and everything. And so Xamarin Forms was just incredible for me to be productive there.
I think a lot of developers like hearing that. They, you know, they know that Xamarin Forms has all this promise, and they want to know whether or not it's real. And it's cool to hear from a guy like you, who obviously they need to be smart like you are, so we've discounted, you know, at least 1% of the audience. But at the same time, it's cool to know you can pick this sort of thing up and be able to deliver something that is actually practical and actually usable, and these technologies aren't just smoke and mirrors.
Yeah, and the thing that always made me nervous about using Xamarin Forms was potentially the having the UI look the same across all of them. And we were able to use a couple plugins that allowed us to customize the UI per device. And so one of those was just, you know, it makes it really nice when you have circles instead of just square boxes everywhere. And so the app has these nice circles across the screen for the filters. And that is something that was developed for each of the individual components. So.
He built us the most beautiful app. And I say this because I had a lot of ideas. It was very personal to me. I presented him mock-ups with what I wished that this app would look like, you know, in a perfect world. And he basically delivered exactly what I asked for in looks. But unlike my mock-ups, his app actually works. So it was amazing to see sort of these ideas in your head and what you want something to turn out, and you've effectively communicated that enough so that someone who knows what they're doing on the software side can deliver what you want. And it was amazing to see. Also, in like a week, I saw something, which was amazing.
Yeah. Incredible. I mean, and that's where Xamarin Forms came in handy. I mean, I was able to do it quickly, but then I was also able to customize it to the point that it looked exactly like the mockups that they gave me. So,
very nice. Very nice. Urban Refuge, what's the future?
Well, as of right now, our timeline for the next couple of months is for the month of December, our organizational outreach team that's actually based in Amman. We were able to crowdfund through BU crowdfunding the amount that we needed to actually finish the database. So they're going to be out there in the field coding latitude and longitude, dropping pins so that we have as many organizations as possible in the map before we launch the app. In January, we'll actually be in Jordan, and we'll be starting the beta testing, and then in February or March, as soon as we're able to do an update based on the testing, we're actually going to do a soft launch with the population, release it in the App Store, build up some kind of momentum, and also see how it works once we have, you know, 1,000, 2,000 users on there. And then in May, we're planning on doing a large celebratory launch in Amman, kind of coordinating a transnational, probably Skype-hosted launch in Boston as well. So we'll have two big celebrations, because the other thing is that with refugee studies, people are always, it's obviously a very difficult subject, and it's a very sad subject most of the time. And for this app, we kind of want to build some excitement and happiness around it, because it's one of those good things. It's a happy development, a good story. And so we're hoping to make it more of a positive celebration in May, when we'll do a media blitz, nice, release it to all of the population. There's about 455,000 Syrians living in just Amman. So it's a large user base out there for this app.
Yeah.
I should mention that the students actually worked with other Syrian kids and Jordanian kids who are around the same age. I was kind of careful about it, because I think the kids in Amman wanted to be more involved from the beginning, but I felt like my students are getting college credit, whereas I'm not compensating these other team members, so I didn't want to engage them too much. But now that we have funding and we can launch, it's like the Amman team can be a bigger part of the story and take ownership. And that was the thing. It's like, from day one, we never said, hey, this is an idea, but we are sure that it works. It was always in conversation with people on the ground who were like, no, this is a great idea. No, like, we should actually do this. So I think it's, for us, that's, you know, talking to them, we got them excited, but I didn't have an app, and I didn't even know, I didn't have funding. I called, like, James a feminist. I was like, you guys are feminists. You didn't even see my face, and you just built something, you know? And I think that that's true, because you spent so long trying to raise funding and write in one pagers and full proposals and PowerPoints, and this is what I want to do. And with the tech community, it's just like, it's incredible. They didn't, you know, I didn't even meet James. I didn't have to, like, present myself and explain myself. Yeah. He talked to my students, and I, at some point in between two classes, I, like, stopped by my office and had a quick conference call, and suddenly I had this product, and it just, that to me is feminism, right?
Brilliant.
Because it really...
James, well, I gotta say, I mean, working with James, some of my best times have when I haven't seen James. So I'm right there with you. James, just in case developers are inspired by this and they're wanting to figure out, where did you go to learn Xamarin Forms so that you could start being productive? Where can they go?
Yeah, I went right to the docs, and then also Xamarin University. So I actually got signed up for Xamarin University and started taking some of the classes there, and that got me up to speed pretty quickly as far as videos. I put the videos on double speed, put the headphones on, and I call it plugging into the matrix. And a couple hours later, I've got the answer.
I mean, people who haven't tried Xamarin University don't know what they're missing. I mean, it is so well structured. It is so step by step. It is so well taught, and it is, you know, they anticipate the next. It's just well thought out, you know. And I think Xamarin University may be one of those lost jewels for developers who are like, how am I ever going to get started with this, what seems complicated, Xamarin world? And there's Xamarin University just waiting there for you. Now, tell me, Vicky or Kate, if this, not developers were inspired, but somebody else is inspired and they want to be part or at least contact Urban Refuge, what's a way they can do that?
We have a contact form on our website. We are interested in hearing from basically anyone who wants to be involved in some way. We have a specific contact form if you are an organization and you want to be a partner, or you want to be part of our database because you're located in Amman and you want to be part of the app. We also welcome, you know, feedback and any kind of involvement from other universities or other faculty. I know that Nora has gotten a lot of hubbub from other faculty members. She's become like this go-to person of like the queen of like forced migration in academia, because she's changing everything. So we welcome all kinds of contact from other universities, because we don't want to be the only city that does something like this. We definitely want this to be a city tool for everyone.
Yeah, nice. I mean, I would like ideally the students to actually create an Urban Refuge syllabus that other teams can use, whether it's college classes or high school classes. But in a structured environment where you already have students, you could do this as a project in your local and just map your local aid. And actually, it sounds like from just people just hearing about it a little bit through Facebook, and BU Today ran an article, and I've just been overwhelmed with the support and interest from other people and other faculty who were like, hey, my students heard about this, they think it's cool, we'd like to try it. And for me, I think that the real push will be to, again, not give just a finished product, but really try to get the same people who are interested in doing this for humanitarian purposes to realize that, hey, maybe they could learn something about coding and it's not that scary, and they may not have the same skills as James or now Kate, and I don't. I mean, I depend on them, but I think that it's empowered me because I also don't feel like I have to learn these methods. I just have to understand how they can be used, and then I know my data sources, which are more ethnographic or archival, and for me then the sky's the limit, because when you talk to people in who have an understanding of tech, their understanding of what the horizon of possibilities is totally different than yours, and so it really opens up possibilities.
Nice. There's nothing like teamwork. James, good job doing good work.
And thank you to
Nora,
James.
Jane, Vicky, thank you for the good work you're doing as well. Best of luck to you,
so
and
thank you
to all of you for being on the show today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you. You bet. Thanks, guys.